Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is October 16, 2019, a beautiful fall day here in Nashville, with cool temperatures and clear skies. The moderating temperatures this week have made it possible to actually get out in the garden and do a little bit of cleanup. In the past several years, the State Parks Division has put an increased emphasis on delivering program activities which are reflective of the resources of our various parks. This has become part of their core mission. A couple of years ago, I began to notice promotions for historical programming which was being conducted at the Alvin York Homestead State Park. These programs involved reenactors dressed in authentic World War I era soldiers' uniforms, giving visitors a sense of what trench warfare was and the hardships encountered by our soldiers. Of course, this was apropos in a park honoring the memory of one of America's World War I heroes. Recently, I learned that the state parks had hired a new director of interpretive programming and education, and that that person who has been hired was the same individual responsible for the innovative programming at Alvin York. That person is our guest on today's program, Josh Wagner. It was fun to sit down with Josh and to learn about his unique background and to discuss with him his ambitions for interpretive programming in our parks. I come away from our meeting with the sense that things are in good hands and that we should expect to continue to see exceptional educational activities in our parks. And so I hope you'll enjoy my interview with Josh Wagner. Josh Wagner, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, it's great that you've taken the trouble to come out and visit with me today. I appreciate it very much. I do want to spend some time with you today talking about your new position as the Chief of Interpretive Services for Tennessee Division of State Parks. Sounds like a wonderful job to have.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to get big shoes to fill. It's a lot of responsibility.
Well, it looks like it could be one of the most fun things that anybody could ever have for a job.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Absolutely.
I want my listeners to learn a little bit about you, though, before we get started. My podcast tends to be about things involved with conservation and the environment, parks and recreation. And I always like to find out what got people interested in that career. Tell me about your story as far as that goes.
Yeah, so I have a strong passion for history going back to when I was really young. Grew up going to national parks, Stones River National Battlefield in Murfreesboro. I'm kind of from Murfreesboro in that area. And so, like many people do, went and got my undergraduate degree in history. Wasn't totally sure what I wanted to do. I was actually in the Marine Corps as well. So I was a veteran trying to find a job and decided, well, I'll go to grad school. And so I enrolled in the MA program in history at MTSU. And while there, still trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up, I did an internship with the National Park Service. They had a public history internship mm-hmm. that they offered one summer. And I had never really seriously, honestly thought about working in for the National Park Service or for Tennessee State Parks or anything like that. And so I did this internship and pretty much instantly fell in love with the life of a park ranger, of what they did. And so I did a season with the National Park Service at Stones River and continued volunteering, continued with grad school, and started trying to figure out what my opportunities were if I wanted to make being a park ranger my career. And so I was looking at the National Park Service, but also was looking at Tennessee State Parks and hadn't really made any connections with Tennessee State Parks, was trying to figure out what they did and ended up reaching out and got in contact with John Froschauer. Mm-hmm. So he used to work up in Nashville in the interpretation office. So I ran into him, got a little information and just applied for some full-time ranger positions that happened to be open. And I was fortunate enough to be hired very quickly at Old Stone Fort State Archaeological Park in Manchester, mm-hmm. which is a prehistoric Native American site. My background is definitely in history, not really prehistory, but it was a great fit for me starting out. I did 4 years at Old Stone Fort. Worked under Keith Wimberly, the park manager there. He's been there for a while, and his predecessor was Ward Weems.
Right.
And so then the opportunity came that Sergeant Alvin C. York, State Historic Park, was needing a park manager. The park manager had promoted up to picket and threw my name in the hat and got it. I was incredibly excited for that opportunity to be the manager of Alvin York during the centennial of World War One. So this was 2017, 2018. And my background is, at least my education, academic background, is really in American military history. So it was a great fit. So I got to be up at Alvin York throughout the centennial, the 100th anniversary of America's involvement in the First World War, America's ending of the First World War, Sergeant York's actions, the 100th anniversary of his actions, and got to do a lot of wonderful things in the 2 years I was up there. And here, about 2 months ago, I started my new position in Nashville overseeing interpretation in Tennessee State
Super.
Parks.
You know, I guess it was when you started at Alvin York that you certainly came across my radar screen, because all of a sudden I was seeing program activities happening at Alvin York that really had never happened before up there, at least in my observation. That tended to be kind of a sleepy little place. And you started doing interpretive programs that involve reenactment of World War One sort of things. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so kind of going back to about 2015, a couple of years before I became the manager of Alvin York, there had been a movement kind of starting within Tennessee State Parks with my predecessor, Jeff Wells, who saw an opportunity to take advantage of the 100th anniversary of World War One. And Sergeant York's story and taking advantage of that timing to kind of re-envision and put some resources back into Sergeant Alvin C. York State Historic Park. That park had been around for almost 50 years at that point and had seen, you know, relatively little funding during its existence. And through the work of Jeff Wells and the administration at the time and several other people, the park manager who was there, which was Travis Stover and the York family, massive amounts of funding were found and poured into that park, infrastructure improvements, things like that, but also a lot of funding was allocated for interpretation, so specifically living history interpretation, World War One. And so I have a background in doing living history interpretation, and when I got to York, I was very fortunate in that I had a lot of resources that people normally don't have, at least monetarily. There was a lot of funding out there because it's the centennial of the First World War. And so began developing, expanding upon what already existed and developing a very vibrant, active, kind of cutting edge in ways, living history program telling the story of Tennesseans' involvement in World War One and Sergeant York's story.
Well, it's a terrific story. I believe that the person that was managing the site when I was involved was actually one of the children or grandchildren of Sergeant York. It was Andy York.
Yep, Andrew
believe.
York. Yeah. He's still alive. He's, okay. Sergeant York's son. Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, I remember meeting him, getting to know him a little bit, but he was more or less just a caretaker of that facility and was available and around to answer people's questions and talk to people. But there was really not a lot of programming going on up there.
So he was pretty much the soul. He was a park ranger, and he was the sole park ranger for that park for decades.
Right.
He did what he could, you know, but being a one-man act,
exactly,
even a small state park is pretty difficult.
Well, to your credit, there's an amazing Tennessee story there at that that is represented in that place. For our listeners that may not be familiar, tell us where that park is.
So it's in Powmow, Tennessee. So it's in the north end of the Cumberland Plateau. So if you're driving between Nashville and Knoxville and you hit the town of Crossville, go north, right up just a few miles from the Kentucky state line.
Okay.
So it's a very rural area. It's not far from Pickett State Park and Big South Fork.
Right. All right. So you are now have come into central office in the Department of Conservation and Environment, Division of Parks. And have taken on responsibility as a chief of interpretive services. Tell us about what that job entails.
So the umbrella that I basically kind of operate within and help guide is overseeing the interpretive programming efforts, education efforts across all 56 state parks. So that encompasses some of what we term kind of program specialists. So we have a group of people that are skilled in cultural resource management, outdoor recreation. We have Randy Hedgepath works within that umbrella, who's a state naturalist. And we also have a whole nother team that oversees our regional interpretive program, or the regional interpreters, and they oversee the SIR program, our seasonal interpretive ranger program.
Right.
So that office, or those folks live within the umbrella of where I'm at. Then we also have a very skilled volunteer coordinator, Nancy Shaleen, who kind of is spearheading all Tennessee State Parks Friends groups and helping in those efforts. So kind of have, we all cross over and help each other out very frequently.
Right.
Because we're a relatively small team, but you basically have a wing of program specialists, and then you have your volunteer coordination team, and then you have your regional intern team that oversees the seasonal interpretive ranger program, amongst a litany of other things.
Okay. So you've been on the job now for a month or two. You've been in the system for several years, so you are familiar with the system of state parks. Have you come to any kind of assessment of what the needs are and what the future is going to be?
So I've been in my position for about 2 months, so there's still a lot of learning to occur, and it's been a sharp learning curve. It's a 56 parks have 56 different stories that we're trying
exactly.
to tell, and 56 different needs. But the big thing is that I'm hyper focused on is maintaining our ability to serve those parks, because every one of those parks I view as that's where our frontline interpreters are. I'm not really doing day-to-day interpretation up in central office in the Tennessee Tower. So focusing, making sure our efforts are focused and honed in supporting each individual park that's out there and the interpretive staff they have, and helping cultivate and train them to be better interpreters, and things that they're trying to develop, and if they need assistance in developing those things, figuring out how we can
right.
help push the ball forward.
Yeah. Have you identified any weaknesses that you think that need to be worked on, or strengths that need to be expanded around, or how are you looking at those kind of things?
So Tennessee State Parks is pretty fortunate. There's at least been almost a decade of pretty heavy support for interpretive programming, and it goes back further than that, I know, but
right.
So things like the Certified Interpretive Guide program through the National Association of Interpretation. So Certified Interpretive Guides is kind of a certification process that Tennessee State Parks, going back several years, started implementing, that all park rangers would have that level of certification. So there's already been some really progressive
all park rangers
and park managers.
Okay.
So that's and that actually is pretty much 100% completed. So that works.
So what's involved with getting that certification?
So it's a multi-day course that involves basically learning the fundamentals of interpretation, the history of interpretation, best practices in interpretation, knowing your audience and things like that. And it kind of culminates in a test and an oral presentation where you actually, amongst your peers and also a panel, you present a program that you're judged and graded on. And there is people that fail. So it is not just a give me kind of certificate. And over the past several years, Tennessee State Parks has literally had every ranger and park manager achieve that, go through that course and receive that certification.
So is this something that you have developed personnel within the agency that do the training, or do you have to bring a vendor in to do that kind of training?
So this all was developed prior. I can't take any credit.
Right. No, I understand.
But so in its origins, we had to utilize people like Dr. Philip Smart out of UT Martin, mm-hmm. who's been very involved with the Certified Interpretive Guide program in NAI. So early on, he was one of the key people that helped guide us along this path. And over time, we've used our own staff to go get basically certified interpretive trainer certifications.
Gotcha.
So they can,
gotcha.
So we can
keep it
teach
in-house.
The course. Right, right.
Right.
And so we now have within the interpretive programs office in Nashville, we have certified trainers, and then we also have park rangers and managers out in the field that also are certified in it. So we have a pretty big team now across the state that can certify our staff.
And of course, that would include you know, everything from the campfire program to something more sophisticated involving World War One or the Revolutionary War.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So it focuses on, you know, a lot of the focus, you know, things like knowing your audience and subject, knowing how to interpret the subject you're presented with professionally and responsibly and sensitive to your audience and things like that. So, yeah, it's a very well thought out and well developed program.
Fantastic. As we go across Tennessee, you have such an incredible array of resources. Any fun things coming up that have to do with interpretation out there?
So because of my inherent bias of Sergeant up in St. York. So,
okay.
Right now we're inching up close to the annual Veterans Day Living History Program, which has tremendously evolved in the past several years. It was originally a program that really had limited interpretation going on. It was more just kind of a community gathering to now. They're seeing 7,000 or 8,000 visitors coming out to a very, that's more people than live in the actual town the park's in. And you have really cutting edge living history interpretation going on. That's, you know, talking about the women's experience in World War One, mm-hmm. The home front experience, the soldiers' experience, but with an effort in all the programming occurring at that park, and what the new park manager has been working on is sensory and connection type interpretation. So things that really will place a visitor in an environment where some of the sensory type elements that were experienced by a soldier during World War One, for example, that visitor can kind of connect through sharing that same sensory. So a smell of smoke, or what chemical gases would have smelled like, if that makes any sense.
Yes, yes, of course.
Yeah.
That could be a pretty powerful program.
And we also have the History Timeline event, which has been a kind of a really prominent program the Bicentennial Mall in Nashville has offered coming up this weekend.
Right. So that was the subject of our broadcast last week with Jessica Gossett.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us more about that.
So that's an exciting program. So the park manager, Jerry Wooten, has put a lot, and his staff have put a lot of work into truly creating a history timeline. So down at the Bicentennial Mall, there's a timeline along the monument wall that traces Tennessee's history from prehistory up until really the Desert Storm. And so park manager Jerry Wooten and his team have brought in, I think, almost 50 different living history interpreters to represent different time periods along that massive swath of time. And I'll be down there this weekend helping interpret some of the Tennesseans' involvement in the Second World War and telling those stories. And you can come hear about experience in Desert Storm all the way to DeSoto and all sorts of different things. So it's an incredible event if you've never been there to get a real snapshot of Tennessee's massive amount of history.
Fantastic. You know, I subscribe to all the friends pages of the various state parks around the state. And so I'm constantly getting information about programs and things that are going on, which is a really fun thing, and encourage my listeners to do that. Sycamore Shoals and the Davy Crockett birthplace tend to always have some really interesting cultural thing going on. Now the Davy Crockett birthplace is now more of a living history farm set up than it was when 30 years ago when I was involved. What do you know about that? What can you tell us about that?
So the changes that have occurred out at David Crockett birthplace is somewhat similar to the changes that occurred at Alvin York. So okay. My predecessor, Jeff Wells, went in and helped secure funding and efforts to re-envision, you could use that word, I guess, Crockett birthplace.
Right. And this is the little park that's just about, 25 miles south of Jonesboro, Tennessee. So it's a little bit remote,
yeah,
but a beautiful little place.
Right along the Nolichucky River
right there.
Exactly. It has a small campground, a swimming pool, kind of your typical smaller camping recreation type park that also has the historic element, telling David Crockett's early life story. And so going back about 3 or 4 years ago, Living History Farm, so reconstructed cabin dating to the period of David Crockett's early life was was built out there, and that site has evolved now to where it's kind of truly is a working farm. They have animals and pretty regularly living history interpreters dressed in period clothing down there working at the farm to give visitors that experience where you walk up and it's like truly stepping back in time to see the world that David Crockett, when he was very young, would have lived in. So,
and that's something that's there virtually every day in terms of something that the visitor can see.
Correct. It's a permanent installation.
Right. Yeah, it's not like an event. You can just, it's something that's constantly there.
Right.
So,
right.
Well, that's a place I encourage visitors to go to. My recollection of the history of that little park was that at one time was a Campground of America campground that I guess went belly up in terms of financial for that little business went belly up, and somehow the state got a hold of it, which was a challenge at first. But it's fun that it's really taking on a life of its own.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible to see a park that transforms from kind of like a KOA type campground
to
truly a pretty cutting edge cultural resource management historic oriented.
Well, I know they've done some archaeological research there, and
they had done some work with ETSU, right. I believe, had done some digs out there, and so they're still working to uncover more evidence of the early story of Crockett and the community that lived out there on that space.
Tell us a little bit about Sycamore Shoals and what's going on there.
So Sycamore Shoals is also a very active site. So they have a reconstructed fort, if you've never been there. So it kind of reflects that period of time during the American Revolution and that what we sometimes refer to as early frontier, at least in this part of the country. And so visitors can go there and experience what an early American fort would have looked like. They can go into their museum, which has a very well done museum with lots of exhibits and interpretation focusing on kind of the early Tennessee story and that part of the state and the American Revolution and the role we played in it and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they also have their famous play Liberty, which is hosted out there. If you've never been to that, it's an awesome opportunity to take in on kind of it's a living history type program, but it's theatrical, so it's a kind of a dramatization, but it's very popular. It's come across the state at different points and is a kind of one of their mainstay headline programs.
So that little park, Sycamore Shoals, is in Elizabethton, Tennessee. Do I recall that there is a historic home associated with that park as well? Carter home or something like that. Tell us about.
There's a Sabine house, I think, is right there. So those are some properties that also. There's a gentleman out at Sycamore named Chad Bogart. He's a museum curator type position, and so I know he does some work out at those sites doing interpretation, as well as the general staff at Sycamore Shoals. I know is pretty active in doing interpretation out there at those sites as well.
Fantastic. You know, one of the things I like to talk about with people about the Tennessee State Parks is the influence and importance of the Civilian Conservation Corps and WPA as really throughout the park system. Is this something that you're going to have any kind of emphasis on?
So I very much am interested in improving and really sharing the story of our CCC connection, Tennessee State Park CCC connection. So even while I was at Alvin York, we were doing a kind of some early ground laying programs talking about Sergeant York. Alvin York was involved with the CCC. He was a superintendent at the Cumberland Homesteads out there where Cumberland Mountain is. So Alvin York was involved with the CCC, and it's something that me and the staff were interested in. So we started developing some programs, and the gentleman that's the curator at York, named Joseph Gamble, has done a lot of research, and he started working with CCC connected parks across our system to try to develop a living history program and telling those stories. Recently, I was out at Frozen Head State Park with Hobart Aiken, who's kind of our cultural resource manager that works with the team I'm over. And we were out at Frozen Head looking at where the location of the original CCC camp was within the park property. Mm-hmm. And talking with the park manager out there, Jacob Ingram, on ways we could maybe start doing a little bit of interpretation out there around or near the site of the original camp, mm-hmm. and developing some management plans of how we could even, you know, maybe big picture, put interpretive panels out there marking the original footprint of the CCC camp and stuff like that. So that definitely is something I want to continue to foster and encourage out there at a park level. You know, Texas State Parks has done a great job with embracing their CCC legacy and heritage, and it's something I want to see us embrace as well, even more than we do now, because it's a very proud heritage, and it connects us to multi-generations back of protecting these sites.
That's exactly right. And I'm thinking right now about Meeman Shelby, which is, for our listeners, is way out in just north of Memphis, Tennessee. And how beautiful the buildings are that the CCC folks put up in that park. There's a one particular, I guess you'd call it a dining hall building, that's exquisite. Any program opportunities or things out in the future having to do with Meeman Shelby and what happened there?
So there's been efforts predating my taking on this position. There's our cultural resource manager has been out to Meeman Shelby looking at their CCC structures, and there's really been, going back 2 or 3 years, has been an effort to go in and really start documenting and looking at our surviving CCC structures, because like you said, that architecture is iconic. It's what, you know, the public imagines when they come into a state or national park.
And exactly,
we can't very easily rebuild the, you know, that style of structures. It'd be incredibly costly, and the craftsmanship really just doesn't exist anymore. And so there's been an effort predating me to document and acknowledge we need to take better care of some of these CCC structures we have, and make sure there's interpretive wayside paneling and things like that that's mm-hmm. interpreting to the public why, you know, what this building is, why it looks so cool, what it means. So,
Josh, you know, when visitors visit a Tennessee State Park, typically there's a visitor center or some place that's the park headquarters that includes at least a little bit of interpretive exhibits. Some are more elaborate than others. I'm thinking about the elaborate setup at Fall Creek Falls, the Betty Dunn Center. Some are not so elaborate. Who's responsible for delivering those kinds of physical displays and fixed exhibits? Is that part of your responsibility?
So that's a good question. So over the decades, Tennessee State Parks has had a dedicated exhibit team and a team that worked in the installation and construction of those interpretive panels inside museums and nature centers, visitor centers. Right. So where we're currently at now is the gentleman I spoke about a couple times already, Hobart Aiken, who's our cultural resource manager type person. He really has been kind of a one-man act with assisting parks with interpretive panel redesign, exhibit redesign, and things like that. So some we have done through Hobart, his efforts in-house. Some parks kind of doing it on their own. We have outsourced some of those projects as well, kind of depending on the scale of them.
Okay.
So that's something that I'm looking at in my current role in establishing how much that demand is, which it's pretty high from the parks.
Yeah.
And is this a demand that we can take on internally? And if it isn't, how do we do right by the parks and the sites and making sure these museums and exhibits are being updated and taken care of, you know, to a pretty high professional standard. Yeah.
30 years ago, we had a team of folks who were actually carpenters and graphic artists and such as that, that could actually physically construct, cabinetry that were installed in these buildings. And they did a wonderful job, and some of the things that they've done are still fresh and installed in the various park sites. But doing it in-house became very cumbersome in the sense that they could only do them one at a time, and all the other 50 parks were waiting for their turn. So keeping those things fresh is really a challenge.
Oh, absolutely. And especially we've kind of, a lot of parks, like Old Stone Fort's a prime example, had gone about 20 to 30 years. And it was still a great exhibit work that had been done by people like Dan Weber and his team.
Right. That was who I'm speaking of, Dan Weber and his group.
Yeah,
right.
So his team had done great work in the museum at Old Stone Fort, but just 30 years of time will make interpretive panels age and exhibits will kind of fall apart just due to time. And so they'd done great work, but 30 years is a long time to expect an exhibit to be able to stay fresh and relevant.
Right.
And so Old Stone Fort has over the past several years, redone most of the their museum, and that was through a partnership with MTSU and the Center for Historic Preservation and the Public History Department. And that was a great partnership, and it's resulted in a great update of their museum. But, you know, that was, you know, one park can't, or 56 parks can't ask every university around them to help with these. And we have one guy in Nashville doing these. So it's definitely... it's a need, and figuring out how we can best serve that need is
well.
Challenge.
It's expensive to hire that done too.
Yes.
You know, when you get the people that have the credentials to deliver a program or a fixed exhibit like that in some narrow subject of archaeology or of natural resources, either one, it can be very costly.
Yes, very costly. And, you know, we've been fortunate that, you know, I kind of have a background and somewhat of a background in museum management and kind of can feel my way around that world. Hobart Aiken, the cultural resource manager, is currently getting his PhD kind of in that field. So we do have some people that are knowledgeable about it, but the cost associated even just with if we could do it ourselves buying the materials is still very high.
Right.
You know, grant sources are out there, but it's just a challenge. It's just a challenge finding enough money for all 56 parks for these types of things is hard.
So if a listener is interested enough to want to give you and your team feedback about what they've observed when they've visited a park, tell us about the process of getting the public involved in what you're doing.
So there's different means and mechanisms. So almost every state park has a friends group. So a friends group is a great way. You can join a friends group, and that friends group is pretty tightly connected to the management and direction of those of the parks. So by being a member of the friends group, you can kind of get your voice heard and be kind of involved in some of the decision making and things going on. You know, people can feel free to reach out to me directly if they had questions or things like that. But our the interpretive team itself, we don't really have a easy clearinghouse for public questions and things like that. We mostly are, a lot of our public interface occurs
through the actual parks.
Through the parks, right. Or if there's kind of a public meeting on some sort of change that's occurring. A lot of times, if it involves our spectrum of interpretation, we'll have someone from our staff there. I hope that answers your question.
Well, it does. I would like to point out to our listeners that there are friends groups with not all the state parks, but virtually all. Mm-hmm. Some are more active than others. I was talking to one park manager recently and basically said that, you know, they're having to sort of re-up their friends group to kind of recharge it and get it reorganized and back into working order. These things take a little care and feeding a friends group. So if listeners are interested in a particular park, approach the park manager about being involved with the friends group. Let me ask you about Cedars of Lebanon. And I've recently observed that they have a living history farm sort of thing going on adjacent to Cedars of Lebanon. Tell us about that.
So I'm not super up to speed. You know, that program is still kind of in its infancy.
The Smith Farm or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
okay.
It's the park manager out there, Buddy Ingram, has been working on that project. I think it's been something he's been shooting for and trying to make happen for a while. And so... I honestly haven't been super involved in that project. I know it was already kind of moving forward prior to me arriving. Buddy Ingram does a great job with what he does out there, and I'm sure whatever he's working up.
Well, this is a small area mm-hmm. that's adjacent to the park. It's actually part of the park, but I've not been there, so I can't describe it personally. But apparently, it was an older farm mm-hmm. that they're trying to use as an example of how farming was done in that area.
Yeah, it's if you're familiar with the entrance of Cedars of Lebanon, it's just stone's throw from the entrance across the highway there. Right. And as far as I know, it was circa 1900 farmhouse, I believe. And so Buddy and the Friends group there, I believe, has done some work in getting the house kind of restored a little bit and using it as a kind of a medium or a mechanism to interpret early 20th century farm life and home life and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. I think some of the WPA era stuff. So,
well, that's one of the things that's on my list of things to go and visit in the Tennessee State Parks. Another place that I have not visited since its inception is the New Johnsonville area.
Oh yeah.
I've been to Nathan Bedford Forest State Park and, they have their own thing going on there. In my day, this was kind of a newly acquired area at Johnsonville. Tell us about what's going on there.
Yeah, so Johnsonville, they actually have a big event that I failed to mention earlier coming up. So their Civil War Days is at the beginning of November. So that's kind of...
Tell us where that is so that our listeners will know.
So if you're familiar with, trying to think the closest town to New Johnsonville, Tennessee.
Waverly, Tennessee.
Waverly would probably be mm-hmm. the closest town people are familiar with. Okay. So right across the river from NB Forest State Park. So New Johnsonville is a site pretty focused on the Union Supply Depot that was constructed there along the river. So it was the site of a fairly big engagement where the Supply Depot was attacked. Park manager Jerry Wooten, who currently works at the Bicentennial Mall, was the previous park manager at Johnsonville. He actually just wrote a book that's been published and I think available for public purchase now, talking about the history of Johnsonville and the Battle of Johnsonville. But so that site is similar to York in some ways. It's a smaller staff park with a heavy focus on cultural resource, historic interpretation stuff.
Heavy focus on programming.
Right.
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 So when a visitor comes there, just on any given day, there's something going on.
Right. So the park manager there, Bob Holliday, is very active. He has a very vibrant programming regimen out there. So they're very active, being that it's just a park manager and a park ranger.
Sure.
And there's actually two park rangers there now. But they have a great museum. It's very well done. The interpretation of the battle, the story of the enslaved peoples, the USCT, and different peoples that were involved at Johnsonville, the Supply Depot during the Civil War. Their interpretation of that is great. And a lot of that was done by Jerry Wooten when he was the park manager there.
Well, fantastic. That's a place that I really do want to actually go and visit. I also need to get back to Real Foot Lake. It's been really several years since I've been out there. I can remember flying into Real Foot, at the landing strip there at the park,
with the
commissioner one day to dedicate a new museum that was dedicated in 1986 or 87. Now you all have some new things going on out there.
So they're working on their kind of visitor center, interpretive center. That park's incredibly vibrant, high visitation. So I believe they're coming up on some of their big fall festivals. The photography programs that
exactly.
A gentleman named David Haggard, who works out of my office, he's the West Tennessee regional interpretive specialist, the photography workshops and the photographers that flock from across the country to come out there and not only see the eagles, but all the other birding opportunities. He stays busy out there and that park stays very busy out there with that. And as you spoke about, so there used to be the air park there.
That's
there was
right.
all sorts of different cool history going way back.
Right.
Involving the history of Real Foot, but
yeah, there was a small hotel out there by that airport. I don't believe it's used as a hotel anymore. It was so remote that nobody could ever get there.
Yeah.
But it was a cool place while it lasted. Let me ask you this, and we'll have to close here in just a moment. Recently, our friend Bob Fulcher was given a national award, I guess from the Smithsonian, recognizing his contribution to folklore in America. It's a big time award. His program that he did starting in 79 or so is still going on out there in the parks. Tell us about what the future is for the Folklife program in Tennessee.
So actually very recently we've kind of started coming up with the game plan, and we've got a first planning meeting coming up. I wish the meeting had already occurred before you asked me this.
Okay.
I could give you some better details.
All right.
So we're working with sitting down with Bobby.
Okay.
And wanting to really to make an effort to continue the oral history program as it existed under kind of his watch, and ensure, you know, the knowledge that Bobby has is being captured and saved in a responsible and long-term way. As you spoke about, you know, he just was in Washington, D.C. getting a pretty serious award. You know, he's a gem that, he's also a park ranger and was park manager. You know, he's been with our agency for a long time. And,
right.
And the work that he has done is will never be able to capture what he's captured again. You know?
Well, there's a legacy out there, even going into NB Forest and the museum of the Tennessee River that's there at NB Forest State Park.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall Bobby spending a lot of time out there interviewing the old timers that were rivermen and mustelers and that sort of thing along the river. So it's that sort of outreach from the parks is a tradition in our state park system. I'm glad to hear that you are on it.
Yeah, we're going to keep it rolling. We're going to keep it rolling for sure.
That's terrific. Josh, so what else does the future hold for interpretation in our Tennessee State Park system?
So, obviously we've got to, every day we've got to be out there telling the story of all these sites, because if the public doesn't know these stories, they're going to lose interest in protecting and preserving these places. But some kind of things that I think are important that we're looking at, or I'm looking at, and maybe over the next year trying to develop some sort of, you know, systematic training and brainstorming on is, you know, digital outreach through, you know, mediums like Facebook and Instagram and things like that. So for reference for your listeners out there, if you go to Alvin York State Park's Facebook page or Port Royal State Park's Facebook page, you'll see programs or mini snapshot programs that are being offered through social media, oftentimes with catchy people in living history dress and some thought put into them. But some parks are out there doing basically mini programs via social media because, you know, in this day and age, there's lots of people on social media and, they're not reading the newspapers and things like that. So we need to be progressive and on top of our game with making sure we're reaching the public where the public's at. And I feel like, and a lot of the data shows that a lot of the public's online, on their phones, looking at social media. So being thoughtful and, exciting in the social media content that we're putting out there, I think is critical. And I think interpretation is a part of that package. So
fantastic. Josh, I want to thank you so much for coming in and spending some time with us today.
It was an honor. Appreciate it.